Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. I am your host, Tony Black, and I'm involved in this episode when I didn't necessarily expect to be. And it's quite a pleasure to be on discussing the second episode of the third season of The X-Files, Paperclip, a pretty legendary episode. And I'm flanked in this one by two luminaries. In fact, I'm going to go as far as to say super luminaries of X-Files discussion and analysis. Firstly, Darren Mooney, back again after the blessing way.
Hello, that sound you can hear is my eyebrow being arched very, very far, but thank you very much, Tony.
you thought you'd get called a super luminary today. I can't even say it now. I can't even say it twice.
What was the description you used the first? The auspicious Darren Mooney, I think? The luminous Darren Mooney.
I've got my thesaurus and my dictionary, and I'm just going for it. And joining us for this discussion, I think this is the first three-way discussion on the X-Cast. For the first time on the main episodes of the show, apart from the Podwatch, it's Chris Knowles. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here. And you can call me the X-Files Illuminati.
Perfect. Yeah. So, yeah, it's really exciting to be on this episode with you guys. And before we start talking about Paperclip, which is a legendary epic of an episode, to round off the Anasazi trilogy, which obviously we've been hacking into, I realised that as we were inviting Chris on, that because this is the first time you've technically been on the main show, that you've never done the five questions of X, which is something we bust out every now and then when we get a brand new guest, even though you're not a brand new guest, you know, you're a semi-brand new guest. But anyway, yeah, it's an excuse.
I've been sitting at the kiddie table all this time.
So. For the 20-minute episodes, yeah. So we're gonna do this. We're gonna kick this off. Now, a lot of people may already know the answers to this because, you know, you've written books and you've got your own blog and other podcasts and things like that. But this will be fun to go through. So Darren and I are going to quiz you on the five questions. So the best way to kick off is with the first one, which is, Chris, when did you first discover the X-Files?
As soon as the promos went up on Fox. At the time, my wife and I were real big Fox watchers for some reason. We were really into, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but we were really into Beverly Hills 90210 and Melrose Place and The Simpsons. And we really enjoyed watching the shows on Saturday night, which, let me try to remember, it was Cops, America's Most Wanted, and Sightings. And I believe that the promos for The X-Files first went up on Sightings. And I was really confused because I thought that The X-Files was some sort of spin-off of Sightings because, yeah, you know, it was obviously covering the same material. And so I would, you know, I mean, 9, 10, 93, 9 o'clock, I mean, I was there with bells on, you know?
Yeah, that's great. You know, I remember Sightings. I loved Sightings. I love how you've connected the two there. Darren, question number two then.
Chris, what is your favorite episode?
Okay, this is one that absolutely no one else but me cites as their favorite episode. But my favorite episode is Christmas Carol. You know, the fifth season mythology that wasn't even included in the mythology boxes. But that was my favorite episode. I could elaborate on that, but that is my favorite episode. If you want to know why, I can tell you, but yeah.
I'm kind of curious on that. Well, I've got several questions. I like the way I'm going to press this, but is it just Christmas Carol by itself or Christmas Carol and Emily? And what is it about Christmas Carol that sort of grabs you?
Christmas Carol by itself, Emily was very much like Terma Part 2 in some ways. It's just like, it was weird, like, watching that episode, I just felt like, have we seen this already for some reason? It felt very familiar. Yeah, Christmas Carol, and I'll tell you why. Because I, at the time, I had my first son was 10, and my second son was 5, and, you know, this was a time, it was very family time. My sister had young kids at the time, and we spending a lot of time going up to Boston for Christmas, and it was interesting, too, because it would always snow. Which, you know, it started like the era of white Christmases, I think, was that year exactly. And, you know, it was just a time that was very family-centered for me. So it just felt very real. And the thing that I really tune into with that episode is that it really puts, for me personally, the X-Files in a very real-world context. So you really begin to understand how this drama, you know, this mythology and what's going on with the syndicate and colonization and so on really affects people at like the most basic human level. So it's very focused and down to earth, and I just really can relate to it. It just really hit me. And you know, plus I was just like so crazy in love with Scully at the time, so that's another reason. And she's terrific, and Gillian Anderson is absolutely phenomenal in that episode. And I also thought that John Piper Ferguson was phenomenal and would have made a great
Spender-esque figure.
Well, he was kind of like, you know, to me, I think he's like a proto Doggett. I think that's where they were sort of like playing with the ideas that would germinate into Doggett. You know, sort of like a by the book, skeptical, knee-jerk skeptical cop, but who's still sympathetic. And, you know, you could tell he was kind of crushing on Scully too. So I felt like he was my surrogate in that regard. So
it is nice to have someone defend an episode like that, because it doesn't get a lot of love.
Oh, and plus that last, I mean, the closer, I'm just, you know, Emily is my daughter, just, still, you know, I'm verklempt.
obviously we're still on favorites, so what is your favorite season, then, of The X-Files?
Two. Well, yeah, it's a tough answer. Like, the first season, I'm terribly fond of, and just very protective of, because, you know, I just really felt it all. It was exciting and fresh and different. But overall, I would say the second season is my favorite. And I'll tell you why it's my favorite, because I felt that the mythology kind of became a little too... how do I put this? A little too, you know, what I've discussed with Darren, a little too James Bond, a little too cinematic, a little too, you know, Robert Ludlum or something. The thing I really appreciated, and I think this is down to Chris, and this is something we can discuss with this episode, is the intimacy of the early mythology, how it just felt very intimate, and it felt very personal, and it felt very... you know, intimidating in that regard. You know, it just felt like it was on a very human level. And, you know, when you start having, I mean, it was very exciting the way things developed, but, you know, once things like the black oil came in, it's just like, all right, well, this is a different thing now. This is more like James Cameron or something than what I had been really tuned into. So I mean, that and really this three-parter that we're about to discuss, if I ever shut my mouth, is really, to me, it's sort of like the finale of, you know, Chris Carter's interest in the mythology, you know, what he was interested in. I think what he was interested in was with the politics and the personal politics and the, you know, the human dimension of it.
On that note, then, who is your favorite character?
Oh, Scully. I mean, come on. Seriously.
Softball.
I mean, you know, the series is about Scully. You know, it's her story. You know, I mean, she's the first character we meet. And it's really, the story is about her journey. You know, it's her hero's journey. You know, I definitely think that she was the character that the writers were most interested in, because she had, you know, the most potential for change and for development You know, because Mulder was always just Mulder. You know, he's always you know, his beliefs never change. I mean, well, except for that one arc, that short-lived arc. But you know, I mean, he flew much lower. You know, Scully sort of went through these peaks and valleys, and it was just her character development, I think, is just much more dramatic.
It's telling that loads of people answer that question by saying Scully. So many people and say Scully. Very few, oddly enough, say Mulder. It almost is always is Scully. So I think you're spot on. I think that's exactly what a lot of people feel, really, that it's her character that drives the whole thing, really.
Well, it's kind of like she's Billy Batson and he's Shazam, you know? I mean, you know, Shazam's an interesting character and you want to know more about him, but, you know, Billy Batson's the one who becomes Captain Marvel, so...
Now that's a parallel we haven't seen before.
There's a fresh perspective.
Yeah. Finally then, of the five questions of X, Chris, what is your favorite moment from the entire series if you had to pick one?
All right, this is another weird one. My favorite, you know, my easy answer would be the confrontation with the well manicured man in the cemetery in Blessing Way. But I'll tell you my favorite moment, and it lasts about a second, and it, to me, it's just phenomenal storytelling. It's in Permanum, and it's when
with the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Duffy Haskell is in Skinner's office, and they're sort of grilling him. And he starts, you know, dropping hints that Scully, that he clearly knows Scully's story. And that he knows that Skinner knows that he knows, and Scully knows that he knows. The only person who doesn't know is Doggett. And when Doggett finally figures out and he shoots Scully, this just like withering, piercing gaze that's just, it's so filled with like anger and resentment and just like hurt. He's so incredibly, you know, his feelings are just like he's wounded. Just this one second gaze says so much. And to me, it says so much about, like, the series and what, you know, what the series is really about and, you know, the character arcs. I mean, even though it's not a Mulder-centric moment or a Mulder-Scully-centric moment, just that one second, just when he looks at her, it's just, when you watch it, it just boggles my mind. It's, because to me, the greatest moments in The X-Files are silent. And they're usually like characters looking at each other, you know, communicating with their eyes, so to speak.
Yeah, that's a great one. That's a great one. It makes me want to go back to Permanum now and watch it and capture again.
When I'm watching that episode, I'll keep, you know, just rewinding it to that scene because it's just like, it's so powerful. And you know, Robert Patrick has those great piercing blue eyes that just drill right through you. And that was just phenomenal storytelling. And, you know, if I... Season 8 would probably be... I mean, Season 8 is definitely my top three favorite seasons. So.
Mm. Yeah.
I'd agree with that, yeah.
We all love... We're big Season 8 fans, definitely, three of us.
Frank Spotnitz is on record as saying that that was his favorite season to write, so...
We're in good company.
Interesting.
You can imagine. But yeah, great answers to the five questions of X, Chris. That's brilliant. And... that's a good point to leap off and start talking about the bread and butter, the meat of the episode. So we're going to delve deep into Paperclip. Paperclip, as I said, was the second episode of the third season of The X-Files, first aired on September the 29th, 1995. He's written by Chris Carter and was directed by Rob Bowman. And this episode obviously picks up from the end of The Blessing Way, where Scully and Skinner have guns on each other, and bash, in comes Mulder, and they're off on a mission to explore the secrets of Bill Mulder's past, of the Smoking Man's past, of the Syndicate, and secrets are very much revealed in this episode. So, I mean, this is one of the most well-known and beloved episodes, I think, of The X-Files. But, Darren, you first. Out of 10, what would you rank Paperclip?
This would be a very solid 8, if not even a 9. I really, really love this episode. It's fantastic. It's one of the great mythology episodes. It's not my personal favorite, because I think I've gone on record and said that my personal favorite, like NICE 731 and Patient X and the Red and the Black and a lot of the Season 8 stuff. But this is just perfectly propulsive. And I also feel like I was a little, you know, maybe a little bit mean to The Blessing Way, so I have to be a little bit, you know, a little bit mean here. I can't play favorites that much. But yeah, 8 sounds about right for me.
How about you, Chris? Out of 10. I think I know the answer here. Actually,
oh, like 10 zillion. 10 zillion infinity Googleplex trillion. I mean, come on. You know me.
Okay, why? Go on then. Why is it, like, I assume this is your favorite episode of the entire season, but what is it that makes this perfect?
It's all the set pieces are just so iconic. And if you were, like, you really wanted to put together, like, sort of, like, I call this Paperclip Show, you know, because it's like, if you really wanted to put together, like, the best of X-Files, you know, the most memorable confrontations and scenes, you could take a good 3/4 of Paperclip, because it's just so filled with just classic confrontations and classic scenes. And again, I mean, like, the thing that really strikes me about this episode is just how intimate it is. It's just how its characters getting up in each other's faces and confronting each other with their culpability. And I think that is a facet of the series that I think makes it so great and so memorable, but also gives it, you know, a dimension that makes all this crazy stuff seem just entirely plausible.
Yeah, for me, it's a 9. It's a definite 9. I wouldn't quite give it a 10 simply because I think there are episodes I love a bit more, but it's a high 9, absolutely. And it just never ceases to be all of the best things about the show combined, really. You know, all of the best aspects of the mythology, pacing, you know, drama, acting. It's fantastic. You know, it's a really, really great package. So it's, you know, and you know, the feeling is pretty mutual across the board. You know, on IMDb, it gets a 9.2 out of 10. And that's of 2,939 votes. And, you know, it's only the second highest rated episode of the third season, you know, on that aggregate. So, you know, a lot of people agree that Paperclip is, you know, it's up there. It's up there, absolutely. And it's just got so many layers to it, which I know we'll talk about. But it's a fantastic episode. So, I mean, to start off with then, let's get into talking about it. Because, obviously, it picks up. You know, well, it starts off with one of the Albert Horstein monologues.
Yeah, I love that character.
Yeah, before we get back into the cliffhanger. And it's, again, I mean, Darren isn't a massive fan of the Navajo stuff. I mean, what do you guys think about this opening? Does it set the scene with Albert Horstein and everything he's talking about and the allegory and that kind of thing?
Well, I mean, I sort of talked about this a little bit on The Blessing Way there. I think as a piece of storytelling, the opening monologue is quite clever because it sets up this idea of sacrifice and exchange and offering one thing for another and receiving it from some sort of supernatural entity in the world, and how, you know, that sort of plays into the idea of, like, Mulder who came back from the dead, and then you have Melissa Scully who dies, and you have this sort of, for one, everything that lives, something else dies. You have this sort of back and forth. And I think it's quite effective in that sense. I do think it's a little, and I know that, you know, I like Carter's dialogue. I like Carter's dialogue a lot. I'm actually quite sympathetic to his monologue. As I point out, the fact that you can do something like this on television is amazing. I do think that maybe it's a little bit too much for me in place. It's a little bit too cheesy. It's a little bit too almost stereotypical sort of Native American mysticism for me. But I'm willing to accept that maybe I'm a bit too hard on it in that sense. But Chris, what about yourself?
Well, I mean, put it in the context of when it aired. You know, we're talking over 20 years ago. So I think that in that context, it you're looking at something that hadn't become cliched and overwrought yet, at least in my view. I mean, other people might disagree. But I am, I'm just incredibly fond of Albert Hochstein. And I think that, you know, Floyd Crowe Westerman was a phenomenal actor and just had a charisma and a presence that I think added so much dimension to the storytelling. At any time that he was on screen, he just brought a weight to it that I think served the storytelling very well. So, yeah, I know a lot of people don't like the Native American mysticism and so on and so forth, but I'm just going to say, you know, just completely, you know, egregiously here is that I really connect to this entire storyline because my grandfather was very much involved in kind of Bill Mulder kind of activities of a sort. Actually, he worked on the real-life program that the Stranger Things was based on, which was the SAGE radar program, which had a, you know, they had the installations at Montauk. But also because his father was a Navajo Indian who had been adopted by a white family and was actually born the year that Geronimo was captured by the U.S. Army. So, I mean, this is just completely just indulgent here, but it just, it has like a personal resonance to me because I feel like, you know, it's, I lived it in some ways, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard.
That's a pretty amazing connection.
It's a connection that nobody else, I mean, nobody else, certainly, you know, lots of Americans have Native American ancestry that they don't even know about per se. But yeah, I just, it just gives that an added resonance to me. So, I mean, it's totally personal and indulgent. So I don't expect, you know, you or Darren to really tune into that.
But I mean, I'd argue that most of great art that resonates with people tends to resonate on a personal level as well. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that, you know? I mean, the movies I like, I can all point to for personal reasons that, you know, I can't necessarily share or can't necessarily even articulate. So I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely, yeah. The other obvious thing about this teaser as well is that it does the classic X-Files trope of separating the cliffhanger action before you get out, you know, before the credits.
The resolution.
You
know? Yeah, before the resolution.
Yeah, the resolution. Yeah, and it does this all the time. You know, in it did it in... The Blessing Way was slightly different because it wasn't as direct a cliffhanger, you know, but it does it in things like Colony and Endgame. It does it in things like Dwayne Barry and Ascension, and it does it here, you know. And so by the time we're back out of the credits, we're back into the very final moment of The Blessing Way with Scully and Skinner with guns on each other. And it takes Mulder to bust his way in, back into the scene, reborn, to take down this... You know, this Mexican standoff.
Just in terms of that, it's worth maybe pointing out, like we discussed it in The Blessing Way, but like this is Carter very much subverting expectations, where it's like you're talking about like having that scene, like the teaser not being the resolution to the cliffhanger, and that sort of like being sort of strange in that sense. In a way, The Blessing Way is almost that, just extended to an entire episode. It's kind of like, I think there's something very bold in seeing that, in having a storyteller who's confident enough to actually go, you know, not only am I not going to give you what you think you want at the end of Anasazi and give you something a bit more interesting.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
Provocative. I'm also, even within this season itself, even within the episode airing next week, I'm still going to make you wait you know, a good 4 minutes while I articulate my thematic points before you get to see what happens in the context of, like, the cliffhanger that ended the last episode. I think that's great.
It is really good. And it gives it, I suppose, a little bit of breathing room. So when Mulder does bust in, it's, you know, you feel like it, you feel like it's earned. You feel like you've been waiting for this moment, even though you don't necessarily know it's Mulder behind the door at the end of the Blessing Way, you know, but it makes sense given what he's been through for it to be him, and then to, you know, propel the plot into the next phase, which is really all about the digital tape, you know. And it's that whole question, you know, he wants the tape, he wants to get his hands on this truth, but right now the position him and Scully are in, Skinner, you know, insists on keeping it, and it's, you know, for leverage. I mean, we talked a bit about the Skinner thing in the last episode, you know, how he's portrayed over this three-parter. But this really is the episode where Skinner puts it all on the line for them, isn't it? You know, he really does gamble everything on this tape, on the connection with Albert, you know, in order to try and protect these guys. And in Paperclip, that becomes even more apparent.
There's a couple thoughts here that really, you know, drive home the power of the storytelling here, and that there are two subtexts here. The first is that this entire episode is really about betrayal. Every sort of scene that we go through has that undercurrent of betrayal, of intimate betrayal, you know, of trust, you know, strong bonds of trust being broken by betrayal. And if you sort of go back and watch this episode in that context, you'll see that, and it's you know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, mental cases like me who will watch this episode, I don't know, 50 or 60 times will start to think about. But also with Skinner is that I'm not exactly sure how this played out. I'm not exactly sure what was communicated, because everything with the X-Files is subtext and undercurrent. But, you know, why is Skinner so willing to put himself out so far on a limb for these two agents who are really just nothing but pains in the asses? I mean, what is driving him? What is his motivation? Is it a personal motivation? Is it because he sees that Mulder and Scully are correct, that they're onto something, that they're, you know, unearthing something? You know, he's a very by-the-numbers ideological kind of character. I mean, does he finally realize that his ideals are being betrayed, and that's what drives this? Or is this some sort of, you know, paternal or even romantic attachment to these characters? I think there's just so much subtext that plays out throughout the series, is never acknowledged, is never spoken, but I think that there is a line of thinking that leads you to ask these questions. And it's sort of like what Kim Manners said, is that, you know, you really had to put your thinking cap on when you watch the show, because they're going to show you a lot of things, but they're not going to necessarily explain it to you. And I think that the frustration with a lot of fans is that they expect that payoff, that resolution, everything to be explained and wrapped up. And, you know, when that does happen in this series, it's always just like, oh, you know, why did they do that? You know? I like the mystery better. You know?
That's part of the thing that, again, I think we talked about in The Blessing Way, which is that really after this, after everything that Skinner does in this episode, the ambiguity should have been kind of gone, really. You know, after this, if it's not clear that he's kind of on their side, I don't know what is. So it's one of those things where, you know, the fact that they then, I think, Darren, you said this roughly, that for all the years after this, that they try and throw in a curveball with Skinner, is he trustworthy? You kind of think, well, yes, he is, because of this. Yeah, because of this,
like,
episode.
You're still doing it in Kitten, for example, like, during the 11th season. It's just like, at what point does Skinner take enough beatings for you that you kind of give him the benefit? And I mean, admittedly, in Kitten, I think they do acknowledge that you probably give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, at what stage is there? But again, that's what Mitch Pileggi plays that so very, very well, though, that it's hard to begrudge them from going, let's see him do Conflicted again. Because it's like one of those things that he just has this presence which really, really sells, like, morally conflicted, sort of caught between the rock and a hard place, while somehow being both at the same time. It's remarkable. And I can understand why they do it, even if it does feel like over a quarter century, it's a bit much.
Just a little bit. But obviously they're out with of Skinner's got the tape, they're off, and they go to visit the lone gunman, because Mulder's got the photo which shows here, his dad, Bill Mulder, the Smoking Man, a younger Deep Throat, and various other members of the Syndicate. And I like to think that on that picture is probably Comrade Strughold from Fight the Future, but we don't quite get that confirmed because they haven't quite invented him as a character yet. So, you know, it's... And Victor Klemper, who is the Nazi who was brought to the US under the real-life Operation Paperclip. So this is one of those great scenes in The X-Files and great ideas of, from the real world, from real-life history, that comes in and is weaved in a really fascinating way. And, you know, it's... You know, when you dig into the real life stuff about Operation Paperclip, it's fascinating and disturbing. And they kind of hint at that here. And, you know, I think it's Langley who says, yeah, Klemper's still around, living well at the expense of the American taxpayer, even though he was putting Jews in pressure chambers and all this kind of thing. So it's pretty disturbing stuff that links Mulder's father to these kind of people, isn't it?
Well, it is. That's, as you pointed out, it's all based on stuff that really happened. So, for example, the real-life Operation Paperclip, according to the statistics I have here, transported 1,600 German scientists in the wake of the Second World War. And the results of their research conducted raised over $10 billion since. You have stuff, for example, you have like people who should have been standing trial at Nuremberg who are getting smuggled out, who are working at the US Department of Energy. You know, you have this sort of huge connection that's sort of happening. You have even like Strughold, like, who obviously becomes such a key figure in the mythology, and it's a huge deal here because obviously it's the Strughold Mining Corporation. He is named for Huberta Strughold, who at the time... Like, in the summer leading up to the third season, there was a huge controversy around that going on because, obviously, he had done the exact same things that Langley accuses Kempler of doing, the real-life Strughold, where he conducted low-pressure experiments on Jewish prisoners and oxygen deprivation experiments on epileptic children. And in 1993, the Jewish Congress successfully petitioned to have his portrait removed from a mural at Ohio State. And in 1995, shortly before Paperclip aired, the Air Force actually took his name off the library at Brooks Air Force Base in Texas. And this is a man who, like, when he worked in the US, was described as, and I quote, friendly and relaxed by the people who interact with him on a daily basis. I mean, 7 of the German scientists under Operation Paperclip were employed by the US Bureau of Mines to work in Louisiana developing rocket fuel, which may explain why you have the Strughold Mining Corporation, because obviously it's, you know, working with the Department of Mines to build rocket fuel that took the states to the moon, that took mankind to the moon. And you have this sort of thing that runs through the entire X-Files as a whole, but it's particularly strong in the third season in the context of the Second World War and in the context of the legacy of the Second World War, where it's like a lot of the stuff that we associate with the American century, a lot of the optimistic stuff, Kennedy's New Frontier stuff, a lot of the idea of like mankind's aspirational reach into space and the idea that as a species we can like transcend this globe and we can reach beyond and sort of like we can conquer or we can accomplish anything we set our minds to, it is built on this like horrific like betrayal, this violence that occurred, this sort of like knowledge that was garnered through experimentations on people in these atrocities that we teach about in school, but we don't teach like our complicity in that by using that information. And it's something that's very like, it's very fresh and it's raw, and it's incredible to see that in a primetime television show at all, but see it in a primetime television show airing on one of the four networks in the 90s. Like, in mid-90s, this was blockbuster television, was teaching people about stuff like the Operation Paperclip and Operation Accelerated Paperclip. It's tremendous to see a story that weaves this in, and does it by, you know, it provides the comfort of, like, alien conspiracies and stuff like that, but still getting at something like, this would have been how I would have discovered Operation Paperclip when I was a curious young boy watching television. Mm. I would have been like, that sounds interesting, is that something they made up for this? That couldn't possibly be real. And then I'd pick up a book or an encyclopedia, and I'm like, whoa! And this is public knowledge, and this is out there in the open, but it's something that nobody really thinks about, nobody really draws attention to, and it's incredible to see it, like, woven into the fabric of, like, the X-Files mythology, into this big thing that became such a huge part of 90s popular culture.
It feels like one of those more successful sort of things that Carter does. You know, we talked back in season one about how in space, when the Challenger disaster is kind of there, in the storytelling in some respects, it's a little bit distasteful in the way it's done. Whereas with this, even though it's a horrendous, you know, piece of dark sort of American post-war history, it's weaved in much better fashion in terms of how it connects to this fictional, you know, conspiracy and mythology. It works much better in an episode like this, which is all about the sins of the fathers and you know, Mulder coming to realize, you know, that his dad is not who he thought he was. And it's got this really personal, central, you know, connection to even that all this real world, you know, terrible history that is woven into the conspiracy.
I'm wary about speaking too much generically about American pop culture when Chris obviously is on and knows firsthand and knows a lot more about both the X-Files and American culture than I do. But I remember when I was doing research around this was around the time that you would have had, say, debates and protests around the presentation of the Enola Gay at the Smithsonian, which caused its own like minor culture war controversy when it opened a debate up about whether or not the United States was correct to drop the atomic bomb on Japan, or whether that was a morally justifiable, whether it was the only way to end the Second World War. And a lot of groups and a lot of people were very upset by the implication that maybe it wasn't, or that maybe it was a morally questionable act, or that maybe the Second World War, which is something, and I mean, well, I'm not just talking about the States here, I'm talking about like collectively as the Western world, and I mean even our...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Ireland, which we were neutral in it, but we were kind of a little bit more towards your side. But as the Western world, the Second World War is something that we're very proud of. It's the moment where democracy sort of stood up to totalitarianism. And to sort of to see that questioned in the way that, like, the X-Files does over the third season as a whole. I mean, it does it again in Nicey, it does it again in Piper Ruin Apocrypha. That was really powerful for me as somebody watching television, you know, in the 90s, or watching, who hadn't really seen these ideas and certainly didn't expect to see them in something that was as kind of popular and as accessible and as hip and as happening as this. But I don't want to speak too much because that's, you know, I don't really know. I just know from reading and stuff. But what about you, Chris? Is that fair? Or?
Well, let me tell you what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, and this is actually something that just sort of occurred to me while I was mentally preparing for this chat here, is that when they go into the mine, what they're really confronted with is the real X-Files. I'm not exactly sure if Carter really was processing that consciously, but okay, so they're running around, you know, chasing these little monsters and ghosts and witches and you name it for the past couple seasons, just having these little Kolchak adventures. And then what they're confronted with is like real monsters, real horror, real atrocity in this mine, because they see that these people who we were told to trust have been collecting the most intimate information on us. And of course, this is not history. This is happening to this day, of course. You know, you've heard about obviously all the things that the, you know, data mining and the internet, but also we're hearing these stories now about all these DNA collectors and all these companies that, you know, solicit your cheek scrapings for you know, ethnicity tests and so on, or you know, using this data and selling this data. So I mean, this is not history. I don't see Paperclip as like, oh, well, wasn't all this stuff horrible? But, you know, don't worry, it's over now, and we can just sort of put it to bed. It's like, no, it's much, much more pervasive and invasive than it ever has been. So anyway, like, really what I see here is that, again, I'm not exactly sure how conscious this was or how this was discussed, but it's like, it's almost like this metastatic, cancerous version of Mulder's office that they find in this underground lair is, again, it's, you know, it's very humbling to these characters, because they thought that they were somehow making a difference by collecting all this information that would somehow lead to the revelation of the truth, quote unquote. But really what they're being confronted with is this behemoth that is so much larger than they could ever dream of being, and has done data collection and information gathering on a scale that, you know, is unimaginable. And I think not only is this interesting for the arc of the characters in context of the series, but it's also, again, it's gives us sort of a sneak preview of the way the world is developing now. I mean, I don't see that the kind of themes that they were exploring in this story to be that was unfortunate and you know, mistakes were made, so on and so forth, but you know, we've learned from it and moved on. It's like, no, we haven't. It's the people behind all this just got a lot better at getting away with it, in my estimation.
I mean, one of the lines that sort of jumped out at me watching it this time, and again, this is the great thing about watching the X-Files, is like, I literally just helped Tony do a pod watch, so I've watched the whole thing beginning to end, and now I'm going back and watching again, and I'm finding new stuff in there even now, which is a testament to the show. But like, one of the lines that jumped out at me was like the bit where the well-manicured man was talking about how, you know, you've built a database of basically the DNA of every person in the United States, and Mulder's like using the smallpox vaccine. And why that jumped out at me now is basically what Chris alluded to there, which is stuff like, say, the arrest of the Golden State Killer, and there was another killer or sort of assault perpetrator who was found using the same mechanism, where authorities had basically gone through the genealogy websites where people send in their DNA in order to basically track down relatives around the world. And they discovered that the killer had actually, one of his relatives, not even him, like a cousin or somebody twice removed from him, had submitted their DNA to one of these websites to track down their own relatives. The police put in the DNA from a crime scene, matched it, and were able to track down and identify this suspect using like these sort of private services. And I sort of remember watching that and thinking, literally the only thing wrong, and I'm not even sure that it's the only thing wrong given how little we actually know about the mechanics of this sort of stuff, but the only thing that the X-Files got slightly wrong in this idea is that the government would have to do it secretly, and that private corporations couldn't just ask us to do it and we'd readily do it ourselves.
That's quite a sobering thought, actually, because yeah, it does feel like, you know, we're kind of handing over these rights. I mean, right now as we record, I don't know how familiar you are with this, Chris, but, and all you, Darren, I don't know quite how it works in Ireland, but right now we've got the GDPR thing that's everywhere, which is the new EU law, which requires people to have to opt in order to, you know, give people access to their personal data, so, you know, online. So now you've got, you know, millions of emails from things you'd even forgotten you'd subscribed to saying, do you still want to, you know, be part of our website? Do you still want your email? And the great, somebody on Twitter made me laugh because they put, it's never been so easy to unsubscribe from things across the internet by doing nothing because you actually have to respond to say yes, please, or whatever. But it's just an example of how this whole fear of personal data being corrupted, and, you know, even to the simple point of the fact that certainly in the UK, there is not a day goes by where I don't get a call from either a call centre or the one of the worst things has been a fake HMRC tax scam where they threaten you with legal action over the phone.
If you don't give over your,
and that's happened to me. I had it on a flight back from Rome, and I was just about to take off, and I checked my phone, and I was like, oh my god, I'm gonna get arrested when I get back in the country. And then my girlfriend said, it's a scam, Tony, it's fine. And then I looked it up. But it's a scary thing that these people have access to your phone number, you know, and all this kind of thing, and it's based on the fact that you've put in your details somewhere, and then it's bought by an external whatever, you know, all this data is out there and is easily corrupted. So it's a really pressing sort of concern. And it's like the kind of thing, it's another thing that Chris Carter, in a way, seemed to sense was coming.
Definitely. And it makes me wonder, you know, realizing Carter had all these sort of connections and these little birds whispering in his ear in various agencies and whatnot. I mean, it makes me wonder what kind of information he was privy to. But I just wanted to steer this a bit because, you know, the discussion with the scenes in the mine and whatnot, and we can get into the whole, Darren had an interesting observation, you know, about the CIA death squads and stuff that they're confronted with. But the one thing that I really want to point out, and just, you know, getting back a little more in universe here, or just sort of in the mix of, you know, the production, so to speak, is really give props to Rob Bowman and what a fantastic director he is. and what a great character. You know, he gets all this credit for being very cinematic and you know, really investing the mythology with a sort of cinematic sweep. But I think it's really overlooked how great he is with the personal moments, how great he is with the personal interaction, and, you know, especially with Scully. And there are just so many great moments here where Scully's character is rendered in a way that, I mean, I don't even know whether Carter or Gillian Anderson themselves, excuse me, would necessarily be processing consciously. But Rob Bowman just sort of brings this energy and this attention to the character. And there are just so many great Scully moments where her character and her, you know, her love for Mulder, but also her, you know, her strength within herself is really made very clear. And just to sort of bring it back to, you know, you'd asked me about, you know, these great moments. There's a, just to rewind the clock just a bit, but there's a great moment in Endgame when, you know, Scully gets out of the hospital and she meets Mulder on the bridge. And he's, you know, he's watching the divers dredge for Samantha in the river. And just their interaction and just the way that she is so, she realizes how, you know, delicate this moment is and how wounded Mulder is. And, you know, Gillian Anderson just plays it so beautifully. And it's just like, you know, why not? Why couldn't you tell me? You know, all this kind of thing. And it's just so beautiful. It's just like, it's rendered so perfectly. And I think a lot of that energy is carried over into this episode. And I think that's sort of the subtext later on where Mulder and Scully and Skinner are basically, you know, one of my favorite scenes in the entire series, this whole discussion they're having in the diner about how they're going to save their lives because they have this, you know, this death squad after them. But I think one of the subtexts with that discussion is Scully's exasperation that she represses and internalizes, but her exasperation with Mulder's inability to see how seeing her sister in the hospital would be like really important to her and more important than just like all this stupid stuff with MJ.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
12 and all the rest of it. And I think that, you know, all this, you know, stuff about the real-life paperclip and, you know, the implications of that would really not have the same dramatic effect if it wasn't, again, this intimate, personalized dimension to the storytelling. And I think that's just really important because, you know, in that scene when they're looking through these files and Scully's like, oh my God, that's me. You know, why do they have information on me? And then Mulder sees, like, the file on Samantha, but it was originally his file. I mean, I think these are moments that maybe a lot of fans will sort of gloss over and not really focus on the real-life implications of that. These characters are discovering that what they're investigating is actually their own story. They're investigating, you know, the story of their lives that they didn't even realize, that there's been this drama that they've been a part of, that they've been sucked into without their consent. And, you know, one of the... I don't know where I read this, but there was sort of like this whole fan perspective on the series is that this revelation, and again, this is a fan theory, but that Mulder and Scully were always under observation, that the office was always bugged, their apartments were always bugged, you know, that they were, every word that they said was being listened to by somebody and reported to, you know, somebody up in the chain in the syndicate, and that these characters thought that they were doing something on their own of their own volition to try and save the world, but then realizing that they were just playing a part in a drama that had probably been scripted before they were even born. And I think, again, that's what gives this series and that scene in the mind just so much power and just so much, I think, a sense of tragedy. I think this episode is unbelievably tragic because it shows that the bravery of these characters, you know, particularly Mulder, Scully, and Skinner, the bravery of their characters is really, I don't want to say it's futile, but it's pretty damn close.
What Chris is saying there, actually, which is very important, very pointed, which is that you can't look at the X-Files purely as a political or historical document, or even as a political commentary. And I think, sort of, we touched on this when we talked about the mythology before, but I think Chris sort of really brings it out there. There's an aspect of the mythology that is practically Freudian, that's almost like it's very personal, it's very intimate. Like, this is a story about a son and a daughter, you know, reconciling with their parents' generation, but also reconciling kind of with their parents. I mean, it's telling that, like, when Klemper is talking about, like, the great minds of the 20th century, you know, he mentions, obviously, Freud, Salk, Crick, and Watson, but the first name that he mentions is Freud. And like, Chris alluded to earlier on, the journey into the mind, journey into the minds is very much a journey into another form of the X-Files, but it's also this sort of Freudian journey into, like, an inner cave, which has this sort of, like, Campbellian sort of quality of, like, you know, the source of internal knowledge. And it does become a source of internal knowledge because, obviously, Mulder discovers there something about his family that he never knew, that, you know, that Samantha was taken, first of all, with the consent of his father, but also that he was meant to be taken instead. And it was his father's choice that's at the last minute that Samantha be taken instead of him. And you have Scully discovering that she's in there as well. And you have, like, as much as this is this sort of epic story about American history, it's also something much more intimate, something much more relatable. It's Mulder sitting on the edge of his mother's bed, demanding to know, you know, did his father make her choose? Did his father have a favorite child? Did she have a favorite child? And trying to make sense of that and trying to bring it back together. And you're right that it's actually a big important thing running through the episode with Scully wanting to get back to see Melissa, but not making it. Because, I mean, even in that wonderful scene that Chris alluded to, you have Scully pointing out that Mulder, while he's on the run, while he's dodging all these death squads, he didn't even get to attend his father's own funeral. He hasn't made peace with the fact that his father's gone. It is this very intimate, this very sort of emotional character drama that, like, works on this almost, like, symbolic sort of Jungian almost sort of level of, like, metaphor and sort of and symbolism. And it kind of, I suspect that's, like, it's easy to get caught up in the politics of the mythology and, like, the way that reflects American history. But I part of me suspects that, like, Chris is entirely correct when he says that, or when, you know, maybe I'm reading too much into what Chris is saying, but when he sort of suggests that, like, one of the reasons why the show became so popular is because it resonated and sort of hit on this sort of archetypal kind of quality. Like, I mean, the Star Wars, for example, in the 70s kind of spoke to an entire generation of people sort of, you know, kind of coming to terms both culturally but also personally. Like, it means, I know that the Star Wars films means a lot to people who of a certain age saw it and sort of reconciling with their parents and their own fathers. And I mean, I think that The X-Files does something quite similar, where it's like, as David Duchovny, watching David Duchovny as Fox Mulder, like, trying to reconcile with his father, ignoring all the stuff about aliens, ignoring all the stuff about hybridization, just trying to come to terms with who his father is and how his family turned out. I think there's a lot of raw emotional power in there that Carter doesn't always get credit for writing, because, I mean, you know, even on this podcast, we point out, like, Carter's tendency towards monologues, but he really understands the psychology of these characters. He really understands what drives them, and he uses them to tell a story that kind of that resonates in a very broad way, in a very archetypal way. And I think that it's important. I think Chris is right that it's important not to overlook that when discussing this entire trilogy, but Paperclip in particular.
Yeah, it's funny because I always remember people, maybe with some level of, you know, sarcasm or whatever, but I remember people saying, you know, that this trilogy is like the Star Wars of the X-Files. You know, it really is that whole very condensed journey of the original Star Wars trilogy. Of a man discovering that his father is not who he thought he was, and then having to come to terms with who he is. And obviously, you know, there's a lot left far more open than things were at, say, at the end of The Return of the Jedi. But it is a similar kind of mythic journey, definitely, that he goes on through this episode, Mulder does, in particular. Genuine question, why do you think he changed his mind, presumably Bill Mulder? Because if it was originally supposed to be Mulder, then why did he change his mind and send Samantha instead? Just out of pure curiosity.
Well, that's, you know, another subtext that's sort of revealed towards the end. It's like, I always wondered if, like, Bill Mulder was shooting blanks and knew that these kids weren't actually his, because we get sort of a sense in Redux 1 that both these children were Smoking Man's. You know, the way he sort of clutches that photo of the young Fox and the young Samantha to his bosom before he's shot. I think there's a subtext there that could probably be explored in a little bit greater depth. But and that's, you know, I mean, another great moment. Like, all my favorite moments really have to do with, like, confrontation and betrayal, I would say, because, you know, that great moment in Demons when Mulder confronts his mother about, you know, who his real father is, and she refuses to answer. And, you know, David, I think, is brilliant in that scene, because David is, when he's engaged, when he's interested in what's going on in the storytelling, he can be rather brilliant, and I think he's rather brilliant in that. And I think he's rather brilliant in this, you know, particularly in that scene again in the diner. So I think that, you know, we haven't really discussed Smoking Man, and, you know, of course, he's very crucial to this whole thing. And you know, what Darren has pointed out is just, you know, really what kind of a, like, almost like a farcical character he is in so far as his incompetence. That, you know, he's always just bungling things up, and the people he hires are always bungling things up, and they're bungling things up throughout this episode. I mean, he can't even competently kill off Krycek. So I think that's a very interesting subtext here. But, you know, he has the weight of this organization, so he's very dangerous. But, you know, again, this whole idea of confrontation, I mean, just there's just so many great scenes in this episode. It's just astonishing to me. But, you know, the confrontations between Smoking Man and Skinner, and the way Skinner just sort of sizes up Smoking Man the way, you know, a fighter would, that he sort of just sizes him up, gets his measure, and realizes that this guy is just a coward, that he's just a bully and a coward and a sociopath. But, you know, you take away the power of this organization, and you could just, you know, this guy's just, he's nothing. He's just a, you know, weed blowing in the wind. And that, I think, gives that, you know, that final confrontation, no matter how, or, you know, it might strain credulity in some context, you know, I just think it's a bluff. I think it's just a flat-out bluff, because Skinner has sort of sized up Smoking Man and realizes that he's a coward, and, you know, any kind of bluff is going to rattle him, because, you know, this is a man who lives his life in fear, as we hear at the end of this season. So I think that, you know, getting back to this whole thing with Samantha, I think there's a very complicated family dynamic here that, you know, probably hasn't been explored in some regards, but I think that it is, you know, it's a very telling subtext, because I think it sort of points to just how screwed up these families are, how dysfunctional these families are, and just how, like, betrayal is almost like the air that these people breathe. You know, when you're involved in this sort of, you know, when Bill Mulder says, you know, you've never thrown in, you know, their politics become yours. I mean, you know, I think what he's really saying here is that, you know, it's not only just the politics of, like, these sort of Nazi party ends justify the means, Machiavellian, Nietzschean kind of politics, but also the personal politics of, like, I am above the law. I can do anything I want because I am part of this machine, and, you know, I'm not going to be held accountable for that. So I think that there is something there that I think really needs to be explored, you know, more deeply, because I think that there's an intent there that, you know, and again, I mean, Carter's never going to acknowledge it. You know, Frank doesn't really talk about the X-Files anymore, so we're never going to really understand what's being said here. So we sort of have to go through these episodes and parse out the subtext for ourselves, I think.
It's interesting you bring up the Smoking Man there, because I think this episode especially continues the thought that, Darren, you had in The Blessing Way about how the Smoking Man is effectively middle management, because he gets a big ticking off here from the syndicate, particularly the well-manicured man who's just clearly hates him. Clearly thinks he's just an idiot. And that, you know, based on the fact that he can't keep hold of this digital tape, which is really quite important, you know, to the whole grand scheme of everything they're trying to do. And he really does get shown up. And then crucially, you know, you mentioned, Chris, the scene with Skinner. I think that's the one time you really see him terrified. You know, when he says, "Have you got the damn tape?" You know, that's real. That's real. Yeah. You know, he's genuinely scared because he doesn't, for once, he doesn't know which way the wind's going with this. He doesn't have some sort of plan in his back pocket. And, you know, when you consider where he's kind of ended up, not to talk too much about the most recent seasons necessarily, because we've talked through them so much over the last few months, it's quite nice to put a bit of clear blue water between them now. But he's become a very different kind of all-knowing, all-seeing kind of villain. Whereas in this, he's much more of a middle management, you know, not very good sort of conspirator who keeps getting caught in a web. And that happens throughout the third and the fourth seasons, and the fifth seasons particularly. And this really sort of kicks that off, I think.
Yeah, I mean, just one thing that I just want to say just real quickly is that, you know, personally for me, putting a face on the Syndicate, I don't know, it took some of the mystique and some of the menace away from this. You know, because the episodes that scare me is when we don't see who these people are. We can't put a face on them. We can't identify them. You know, we can't name them. We can't call them out. They're completely anonymous to us. And that sort of almost indicates that they're beyond reproach, but also beyond being able to counteract. So I think it's interesting how those themes from the earlier pre-Syndicate episodes are kind of revisited in Tempest, Fugit, Max, where, you know, the smoking man is not to be found, and well-manicured man, and, you know, all the elders are not to be found. And it's almost like, well, remember how much scarier it was when we just had these people running around killing people, you know, and we don't understand their motivations, we don't understand who they work for, so on and so forth. So I just feel personally is that you never really got the sense that Smoking Man was in charge of anything, because, you know, we're told that he works for other people, and he's obviously, like, sitting in on these meetings and, you know, the inference being that he's reporting to people, because the people who are really in power are not going to sit in Skinner's office during these boring meetings with FBI, you know, brass. So I think that, you know, I think that he became a cartoon character as the series progresses, you know, because it's almost inevitable. It's like, look at the Fonz in Happy Days, or look at Kramer in Seinfeld. It's like, oh, well, this character seems to work, you know, and, you know, the audience always cheers when they burst through the door. Let's kind of keep working with this. And I think there's a little bit of that sense with Smoking Man, you know, because Bill Davis is such a great actor and so charismatic and just, you know, really lived and breathed in that role. But I you know, for me personally, again, this is why this arc to me is almost like it closes out the, not necessarily the mythology, because I mean, again, I didn't even hear that term until much later on in the series life, but it closes out to me the early, you know, those first two seasons, you know, the conspiracy, this conspiracy of, you know, of faceless men operating in the shadows, and this season gives them a face and gives them, you know, silly kind of names and so on and so forth. And, you know, as much as I love these episodes, it just takes a little bit of the air out of that arc for me personally.
Actually, just when you're talking about that, it occurs to me that the show is very conscious of what it's doing in regards to killing off the old mythology and having the new one reborn. Like, that repeatedly through these three episodes, there's the theme of, like, death and rebirth. Obviously, Mulder in the boxcar, for example. But, you know, even the idea of the calf, and the idea that, you know, when the, you know, you have the story that Albert tells at the start of this episode, where he's talking about how the gods basically healed the man by tearing him apart and then reassembling the pieces and binding him through lightning and thunder. And it often, it feels a little bit even like the show is kind of doing that with its own mythology at this point, where I think, like, you're right when you say the first two seasons have a greater air of mystery to them. And what happens here is that the mythology becomes, and you're entirely correct when you say it becomes a lot more like a Bond film, because these are much more blockbuster episodes. The point where, like, Klemper is played by a character actor who's popped up in several Bond films illustrate and reinforce that. But you have a lot more running around now. You have Mulder jumping on top of a train. You've got a lot more impressive stunt work that was obviously foreshadowed by stuff like Colony and Endgame, but which sort of gets emphasized emphasized to the nth degree, like, from here on out. And it feels like the show is very conscious of that reinvention as it's happening. I mean, I will admit I'm quite fond of this period of the show's history, running from like the third through the end of the fifth season, where you have I understand the appeal of the conspiracy as something vast and unknowable and terrifying, and all the more terrifying for the fact that it is unknowable. But I actually, part of me kind of admires the idea or the shift that you get in these episodes towards the fact that, like, if the world is being run by a secret cabal of sort of all powerful men, you know, sitting in some nice dusty room somewhere, those guys aren't really doing a terribly wonderful job of running the world. They're making the world a terrible place, but they're not necessarily the most competent or the most brilliant or the most fantastic men. And I don't want, again, I'm wary of making everything about this political moment or anything like that, but I look at the state of politics as it is at the moment. I look at the state of, like, people who are apparently manipulating things, or who are, you know, casting themselves as, like, the demons and the guys in control and running the show. And I look at that and I think that I don't know if I can swear, but it's a shit show. And part of me sort of wonders, like, part of me looks at that and looks at, like, the portrayal of the conspirators in these episodes and sort of finds something quite interesting in that idea that, like, if the world is being run by a secret cabal of all-powerful men, yes, they are. They are more powerful than people like you or I can fathom. Yes, they have far more influence. And yes, nothing that you or I will actually do will, you know, probably accomplish anything in standing up to them or stopping them. But there's also the realization that they really have as little idea what they're doing as we do on some fundamental level. And I find something interesting in that, something almost like subversive of the conspiratorial narrative. And I really like that aspect of, like, this stretch of the show's run. And I like that you get that with, like, the smoking man here being all panicky. The fact that, like, the well-manicured man, there's a really great moment when he's on the phone with Victor Klemper. And you can tell Klemper, the ex-Nazi, is like, oh, this guy is my best friend. Oh, I told him you were a very vanilla old man. And you have, like, you have this reaction shot from John Neville, which is just like, and Chris pointed this out, so much is said without words, but you have this reaction shot with John Neville where it's just like, I'm talking to this guy. This is what my situation in life is. This is so distasteful to me that I have to engage in polite conversation with a man responsible for atrocities that chill my blood. It's just, and it's so effective and it's so powerful. And I like that aspect of the mythology, that there's a sense that this is a bunch of people who have, like, use their power to put themselves in a position, like, where they're protected and insulated, but also, in the grand scheme of things, aren't necessarily faultless and aren't perfect and aren't in as much control as they would like, as people would like to think that they are, or as people think that they are. And I find something very effective in that, and I think it works very well here. But
there's some interesting things with the syndicate. There's one point where the First Elder says, after that conversation, actually, with Klemper, where the one manicured man tells them that Mulder's alive.
He practically washes his hands when he hangs up the phone. He practically wipes his hands clean.
Yeah, he's so repulsed. But he says, the First Elder says, I think it's time we call our friends. Now, for a long time, who'll deal with this matter? Now, for a long time, given that in the cave you see a UFO, unlike any other, actually, that you normally see, or certainly not the triangular sort of shape that tends to become a lot more common as the show goes on, but you see what appear to be aliens, you know, running around under there. So for a while, the question was, well, when he talks about their friends, this ambiguous term, is he talking about them, or is he talking about the hit squad, this CIA hit squad, this really ruthless hit squad who then turn up to try and kill Mulder and Scully? I think it might be obvious to a lot of people, but I think the older I get and the more I watch it, the more I realise that he's talking about the hit squad. He's not really talking about the aliens. And in fact, there was a point, I think it might have been Carl Sweeney who said it on the basement group, that the assumption is that the aliens are actually more of the hybrid test subjects that we see being gassed in Anasazi. So what do you guys make of that? There's some interesting sort of uncertainty there.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. And I think that it really points to the fact that the syndicate themselves are just like, they are middle management. That the people who are running the show, you know, either, I don't know, in the sort of tortured path of the mythology, whether they are, you know, the people running the show are the colonist aliens, or are they these... you know, more highly evolved hybrids. You know, it's sort of kind of left up in the air, and it almost seems to me that Carter and Spotness are just, you know, throwing these balls up in the air and you know, to be decided later. You know, we'll figure out exactly, you know, how this is going to play. We're just going to put it together a bunch of possibilities, and then we'll decide later which one we like best. So, you know, there's a hierarchy here involved, you know, that the syndicate is middle management. They answer to whoever, you know, whatever alien force you want to name, and that the, you know, like these groups like the CIA hit squad, it's interesting, you know, that they're friends, you know, that the, you know, maybe not the hit squad themselves, but, you know, whoever the hit squad answers to. So there are all these, like, sort of interesting hierarchies. And this is really, like, a through line that is explored throughout the mythology. It's like, you know, you hear a lot of talk, like, you know, we all have to answer to somebody. You know, we're all just cogs in the machine. And, you know, Skinner is sort of tasked to sort of put forth these ideas throughout the series. So it's just really interesting that, you know, it's almost like these people have no will of their own, and they're just playing out these dramas in the context of this machine, this giant, enormous machine that almost seems to run by itself, that, you know, we're all sort of lurching towards this alien apocalypse, and there's nothing we can really do to stop it, because, I mean, even the syndicate, you know, I mean, they end up getting fried, but they seem to be like, you know, this sort of almost like a cartoon Illuminati version within the context of the series, but they're just functionaries. They're just errand boys, you know, in the long run. So I think that is, again, so much of this stuff just is never, they throw all this stuff out there and they want you to sort of pick through it and make your own interpretations. But I think that if there is a fault that I would make with this series is that they overestimate the patience and the attention that the average viewer is willing to invest in this, you know, because you see so much commentary throughout the internet, you know, why isn't this explained? Why don't they make this clear? Why is this all so ambiguous? And it kind of drives people nuts. But I think that sort of like this studied, the studious ambiguity is really the tone that the series is ultimately striving for. And just one more point that I wanted to make insofar what Darren was saying about this, you know, that this sort of puts a cap on the mythology as it stood in the first two seasons and then lurches towards a new mythology that's much broader in scope and more cinematic and you know, maybe a little bit more James Bond. I mean, really what that entails is that entails the torch of the mythology being passed from Chris Carter to Frank Spotnitz, because starting with, I guess with Nisei, Frank is really driving the plotting with the mythology, that it's really sort of put to him, you know, of course Chris Carter is very deeply involved, but it's you know, Chris Carter is saying to Frank, you know, I really like what you've done, I really like your ideas, you know, I've got all this other stuff to look after, why don't you really start to, you know, drive this story arc and see what you can come up with. Because if you really look, I mean, you know, Frank at one point said that, you know, Chris, you know, I'm not exactly sure what point it was at, but that he didn't even, you know, that he wasn't even coming to the plotting meetings anymore. You know, he wasn't coming to the meetings where, you know, they're working the boards for these plot lines. And his contribution was, you know, increasingly in the rewriting stage. So I think that's really an important thing to, you know, that this is kind of a milestone, because this is, again, the torch being passed from Chris to Frank. You know, you can't, you know, the show has to progress. You can't just continuously play the same beats all the time. You have to move forward with the storytelling. But to me, you know, when you move forward with the storytelling, that is necessarily a function of where you move away from, you know, this very close, focused, intimate, personal investment in these stories and more towards Hollywood, you know, to put it bluntly. And that's not a dig. I mean, I love all that latest stuff dearly, obviously. But I think, you know, that formula can really fail and fail badly. And I guess Tungusa Terma is probably the best example of that, where it just flails in circles And by the time it's over, you just have absolutely no idea what happened and why it happened. You know, I mean, I don't know if you get that sense at the end of Terma that I do. So it's
and
like
why it happened that, non-linearly.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem to make any sense. And I think that you know, I think if there's something I regret about, you know, that what Paperclip marks, you know, the movement from more focused, more intimate, more personal storytelling to more cinematic, more sweeping, more quote-unquote mythological storytelling.
Do you know the ending of Paperclip is very personal? You know, the way it all comes together, you know, with Mulder learning these, you know, horrible revelations about his, you know, his father and everything that was going on and what happened to his sister, and then and the fact that Melissa dies, you know, and then you get that really touching final scene where it sort of resets the board in terms of where the series is going to go. You know, Scully says, you know, I've heard the truth, now I want the answers, and that's okay, off we go, that's it, that's your season. In fact, that's the next few seasons, really. That's the next three or four seasons set up, essentially, in that line. That's what they do now, and that's what the conspiracy / mythology episodes is all about. You know, it's all about putting the pieces together now of what this is. Now it's all been sort of teed up, and that becomes the show, really. So it's a personal, very broad ending that, like you've been saying, you've both been saying, triggers the next stage of the X-Files evolution.
I agree largely with what you're saying. I think I'm a bit fonder of the stuff than you are, and I think you're right when you say that sort of transitions from being, and I think there's a very sort of like 70s like parallax view, sort of like All the President's Men vibe to the first and second seasons, and it doesn't entirely go away over the course of the rest of the run, but it does become a lot more 90s blockbustery, where you have, like, you know, they have a point in like the sixth season premiere at the beginning where they're joking about, you know, I saw that in Men in Black, which was the movie that opened opposite the X-Files or around the X-Files, and you're comparing yourself to 90s blockbuster sort of movies, except you're doing it weekly on television. I can understand that shift being jarring, and I can see it there, and I think that it does lose something in that, but I also I would probably be a bit more fonder of it than you are. Again, I point out that, you know, my favorite mythology episodes are Nicene 731, which is literally it's the most Bondian or 90s blockbustery of those like conspiracy thriller episodes, in that it has like exploding train cars and impressive stunt sequences and literally a race against time and a ticking clock. It's very much sort of go sort of stuff, as opposed to like more introspective stuff. But I think Chris is entirely right here. I mean, I think there's something interesting in the show itself, sort of almost like almost dying and reborn in the same way that Mulder is, in that like there's a point of like, it's never quite buried. It is the very clearly the same show that it was in the second season, but it's also fundamentally different. And the show would obviously do this a number of times over the course of its run. It would sort of like die and resurrect itself. I mean, you could argue that it did so in the sixth season when it moved to Los Angeles and it became a different show again. You could argue that it did again in the eighth season after David Duchovny left and the writers had to sit down and figure out how to write the X-Files without David Duchovny. And you could argue that again, it kind of sort of tried to do that in the 10th and I think managed to do it in the 11th, where you had this conversation about how you make the X-Files in the 21st century. So I think that like this is important because it's the first of those like deaths and rebirths, and I think it maybe even acknowledging like the limitations there and sort of the differences and sort of the gap between what it was and what it is, I think this is maybe the most successful of the show's rebirths, although I am very fond of the eighth season as a whole. But this is probably the purest sort of like the phoenix rising from the ashes, or maybe even just like the chicken hatching from the egg, in that it feels like from beginning to end, like I know Chris is a big fan of the second season. I'm actually, my favorite season in the X-Files would be this one, the third season, because it feels like a season that has a beginning, a middle, and an end, that clearly kind of, that builds towards something as it goes, that has like a consistent thematic through line, which is obviously the Second World War stuff. I mean, you could argue that like what Nicene 731 do is they repeat the thematic beats of Paperclip, except this time with Japan instead of Germany, where it's like, oh my god, we welcome a bunch of Axis scientists over here here, and they did horrible things to innocent people, and we use that information for our own scientific benefit, which is basically the same plot we've just watched, just again. But it does play through, and it sort of simmers in different ways, and you have like a clear arc from like the beginning here with the introduction of the syndicate through to the end of the season, where it's revealed finally that, you know, what the aliens are planning is colonization, except it's handled so smoothly that it's not even really a reveal, because it seems like it's the only thing that they could be planning, given all the thematic stuff that's been set up, all the little hints that have been sparkled through and sort of like seeded through the season. And actually, I really like that. I think that it is a death and rebirth, but I think that what it's reborn into here, and like in Paperclip in particular, is just dazzling. It's there's a confidence here that is infectious and sort of just carries me through, and sort of just that leads to what is one of my favorite 20 odd episode seasons of television ever. And it just I watching Paperclip, it almost like makes me want to sit down and watch all 26 episodes again. And it's a rare episode of television that makes you do that. It's a rare season premiere that makes you sit down and go, I want to watch all the rest of this. I think the only one of the few other ones that does that is the beginning at the end of the beginning, the start of the second season, Millennium, is one of those other premieres that makes me sit down and go, okay, if I don't do anything tomorrow, I can watch all of this. and Paperclip kind of does that for me. I absolutely love that about it.
Yeah, it's a tremendous episode, and yeah, we've covered it in quite a lot of detail. So yeah, that's the basic gist of Paperclip. But yeah, before we go, we're going to do a little bit of audience feedback, because we've had some comments on the Facebook basement group from some of our listeners and a few of our patrons and things like that. So let's read through some of these. There's some praise for the mine sequence in particular. Michael Little said, a classic in every sense of the word, talking about Paperclip. So many great moments. The highlight for me being the high adventure in the mine, which is a nice way of putting it. But Winston Pear said, entirely perfection, except for that moment when they run out of the highly secured mine through that rickety screen door. Which is quite a good point, really. We're never going to see it again.
That, because myself and Chris, I think, may have actually talked about this at another opportunity. And I think I made this in a point, but Chris actually came back very, very... I actually really like Chris's answer to this, which is a nice Darren punts the softball to Chris, because Chris actually made a very good observation about that sequence, I think.
But my observation is that it's so atypical of television, particularly television of that time. And to me, it's sort of Carter's perverse, subversive mentality, where, like, you know, another show would have this great shootout and, you know, this heroic self-sacrifice and speeches and all these things being made, and they just sort of run out the side door. So there's something about it that I think is really quite brilliant, but, you know, maybe that's just me.
But yeah, more praise for some of the way things look. Katie Doe said, the scenes in Klemper's greenhouse and the mine are some of my favourites in the whole show. The shot of the UFO light coming in the windows with Mulder silhouetted with Mark Snow's score is absolutely gorgeous. I completely agree with that, actually. That was one of the shots that you see quite often in the promo. In the old days, when they're on VHS particularly, you know, you see it in the promos, and it's so cinematic. You know, you mentioned earlier, Chris, about Rob Bowman, and he every episode, and we've talked about this before on the X-Cast, but every episode he does, it just has that movie touch to it in places, and this is a great example of that.
Yeah, and, you know, plus the acting. And, you know, one scene that we sort of overlooked, and is, again, one of my favorite scenes in the entire series, is the, you know, the confrontation between Mulder and Scully and the well manicured man in the greenhouse. And I, you know, to me, you know, it's the entire arc of the storyline sort of being spelled out, but also just the way, you know, Mulder and Scully are like two kids, you know, finding out that their parents were serial killers or something. I mean, just the reactions and the sense of betrayal and loss that they demonstrate there. I just, you know, Scully, it's so overwhelming for Scully that she walks out. She just can't listen to it. It's just too painful. And again, these are the kind of things I just really wish Chris Carter was a little more forthcoming and, you know, less Sphinx-like and less, you know, oh, you figure it out, you know, in his presentation of the stuff. Because I think not only would it ingratiate him more with the fans, But I think a lot of people who don't pick up on these things, you know, it would sort of enliven the experience for them. And there's just sort of one point that I want to make, you know, getting back to this whole thing with Smoking Man and Samantha and everything. And this is something that I discussed with Carl, is that, you know, this whole idea of, like, was Samantha alive? Was she dead? You know, was closure somehow some sort of betrayal of these hints that they were dropping in the series? And my observation was this, is that the very first scene of the entire series is a girl who's abducted and found dead in her nightgown. So for me personally, when I go back and watch the pilot episode, Samantha was always dead. She was always dead. And I think, you know, there are sort of hints that sort of that play to that, you know, depending on your interpretation. But I think that even informs this episode, because my feeling is that Samantha was always dead, that is foreshadowed in the very first opening minutes of the entire series, that, you know, Karen Swenson is kind of a stand-in for the dead Samantha. And the emotions that run through both Mulder and Scully, because, you know, another sister is lost here, another woman, another girl is lost in this storytelling. You know, again, it's not spoken, it's not articulated, but I think it informs the storytelling, and I think people like Rob Bowman sort of understood that and said, well, we really have to sell this emotion, you know, we really have to make this work.
Maura Function Jaeger says, it's an exceptional episode. I absolutely love the scenes in the greenhouse. The quiet serenity of that setting contrasted against conversations of atrocities and a mysterious conspiracy created such unsettling eeriness. Plus, well-manicured Manny's awesome. Definitely my favourite Syndicate member by far. So yeah, similar kind of things, talking about that scene, you know, which is a tremendous, you know, moment in the episode, you know, and it's something that really resonates with people. Finally, Karen McKenna, she has a little bit more to say. She says, one of my absolute favourite mythology episodes from beginning to end. The confrontation between Skinner and Scully and Mulder in Mulder's apartment, where they have guns pointed at each other, is one of my favourite scenes in the entire series. The scope of the conspiracy really starts to come into view as we learn more about the Elders. Skinner finally getting the upper hand on CSM and getting him to completely lose his cool, and Skinner's best line, this is where you pucker up and kiss my ass. Mulder and Scully on their epic quest together, and she puts that in, you know, quote marks, together throughout, and not separated as they so often are in mythology episodes. The emotional family stuff with Mulder confronting his mom and Scully losing his sister and sending Albert to comfort her mother, which is definitely a nice touch, actually, and pray for Melissa when she can't be there in person. Krychek, the well-manicured man, the lone gunman, so much happening, and yet the themes of life and death, sacrifice and survival are all so clear and are mirrored in so many of the characters' individual journeys. It gives the episode such a solid emotional core. And I think she kind of sums up everything we've been talking about really over this last hour and a half or so. You know, she really goes through all the beats, not just the aspects, you know, the fun aspects, the cool scenes, everything like that, but the emotion within this epic, you know, storytelling. And I think that's something that so many people, when they watch this, really just take away everything we've been talking about. It is definitely a classic X-File, without question, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, thank you to everyone who commented on the basement group about Paperclip. Sorry we couldn't read all of them out, but we really appreciate you commenting. Keep doing that, okay, for every episode that goes up now. Not all, like I said last time, not all of them are going to have necessarily comments, but we're going to do our best to keep those in as many episodes being recorded going forward. So do let us know your thoughts, because it's always really interesting to read these out and to see what you guys think. So yeah, that's it, Paperclip. All done. That's the Anasazi trilogy, the unopened file, whatever you want to call it, in the bag, put to bed. So it's onward into season 3 now. But it's been a real thrill to be on this episode with you guys. So before we wrap up, tell us where we can find you. Darren, you go first. Where do you want to direct people to for more Darren Mooney?
Well, I mean, if you're walking down the street and you have to see a handsome man with a goatee. No, you can follow me online at Darren_Mooney. You can find me at The Movie Blog, spelled with a 0 instead of an O in movie. I co-host the podcast The 250, look at the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time. And I co-host the Scan On podcast, which is an Irish-based podcast looking at the week in film coverage. So there's more than enough Darren for anybody. Your recommended daily allowance of Darren should be well surpassed by this point. Cheers. And Tony, also just thank you very much. It has been an absolute pleasure on my part to be involved in this in any way, shape or form. Thank you. And obviously Chris as well. It's been a huge pleasure.
That's very kind. Yeah, it's always brilliant to have you on. Chris, what about you? Where are you lurking online?
Oh, I'm all, you know, hither and yon, but you can probably just, if you're trying to track me down, just go to secretsun.blogspot.com and, you know, read my lunatic ravings on a, you know, quite regular basis.
Fascinating, fascinating ravings, yeah. I would say.
And there's a you know, there's an X-Files tag there. If you know, it says Chris Carter X-Files, because, you know, I talk about Millennium. I've done a lot of writing on Millennium, which I think is you know, just criminally underrated and overlooked series that
I will second that.
Yeah, that I think really puts a lot of the themes explored in X-Files into maybe a little bit more real world kind of context. But
underrated not for much longer, because the time is now, is coming, guys, our spin-off podcast. So we'll be doing Millennium in the not too distant future, and I know that Darren and Chris will both be involved in that in some fashion, so yes.
Yeah, real looking forward to that. I think the series was just so incredibly influential, which I think is overlooked as well. You know, I mean, you had entire franchises that launched themselves by imitating Millennium.
Yeah,
so
it's true.
There you go.
It's a marvelous, marvelous show. So yeah, we're getting into that as well as The X-Files, so it'll be great to have you guys back on the X-Cast at some point. You can obviously find me, if you want to find me, you can find me at AJ Black Writer on Twitter, and all the details of where we are and what we're doing in the show will be in the credits if you want to listen on to more of my dulcet tones. So yeah, we'll be back very soon for DPO is coming next, which is the Lightning Boy episode, as we're back onto the normal kind of standalones, and Carl Sweeney and Andrew Blake will be joining you for that one. So yeah. Thanks for listening, guys, and remember, until next time, trust no one. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast is produced and presented by Tony Black, alongside a dedicated group of podcasters and X-Files fans. You can find us on Twitter at The X-Cast, and on Facebook if you type in The X-Cast, or at our group, X-Files Basement, an X-Cast podcast fan group, where you can continue the discussion about all things Mulder and Scully. If you want to support the X-Cast further, you can now subscribe and become a patron of the show on Patreon. On Google, just type patreon.com/thexcast. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. You'll see all of our tiers, subscription options and perks, which include early access to episodes, bonus content such as commentaries on X-Files episodes, access to a patron chat zone, and even appearing on one of our patron roundtable discussions. We would appreciate any support you can give the show, so just go to patreon.com/thexcast to find out more. Our title music is provided courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I am Will A Y E.